perturbation calculation, right, has been to start with the Einstein equation, kind of like figure out, you know, what degrees of freedom we have, find buried in all the sets of Einstein equations and conservation equations, the equations that relate to perturbations, that give us, you know, the part that we want, and that gave us the equation of motion for the field. And it really was, it was messy, right? We weren't sure what variable to work with, we weren't sure sort of where to start, and what a coherent set of equations was. So, of course, you know, you can do it in a, as once you know the answer, then no matter where you start, it looks a bit more streamlined, but there's a much, much cleaner way to do the whole thing, which is what we're going to do today. And it's a big relief because not only is it cleaner for the two-point function, but it's actually better for everything else that you want to calculate after that, which we didn't talk about yet. So basically, we have learned a couple of lessons, though, right? We've learned that we need basically one scalar degree of freedom to work with. And we want to get an equation of motion for that, quantize it as you did for your free field and exacta sitter, and then get the power spectrum. But we're just going to do it in a cleaner point. So basically, instead of starting with the Einstein equations, and trying to get, basically we're trying to write some version of delta G mu nu, and we tried to write that in variables that didn't transform, so it was cleaner, and we tried to relate that to perturbation in the stress energy tensor, again in some clean variables that kind of got rid of some of our coordinate transformation issues. But we know that we can get the Einstein equations from an action, right, from the Einstein-Hilbert action, and plus the matter action. So we can actually get the equivalent of this by going back one step. So let's go back and instead start with Einstein-Hilbert plus matter. And there's already a nice way to deal with the fact that what we're looking for in inflation are, you know, equations of motion where we have this background that's sort of setting a clock for us, and we want to look at fluctuations around that, and that was causing us all sorts of problems with coordinate transformations. There's already a nice formalism that sort of sets up for you a clean framework of how to think of gravity, even though of course time and space are really the same, how to think of it in a sense that's more familiar, you know, from classical mechanics or classical field theory, which is to think of sort of an evolution of metrics along spatial slices. And that's just more familiar. Of course, you still have to figure out what to do with the fact that you have to define a time, but there is a clean way to do that. So a nice formalism is this ADM, which is what, Arnowitt, what, two T's maybe? Bezer and Misner. Or it's basically a Hamiltonian form of GR. So I think you've seen this at least briefly in your quantum gravity course. And also Latham mentioned it just a little bit. Okay. So I think you've seen it a little bit, but I'm gonna go through it because really this is the nice clean way to get the result that we're after. So basically what we want to do is So the idea of this ADM is that we're going to basically set up for ourselves, and I wish I was a better artist for you. You can look in textbooks for pretty pictures, but we're going to set up for ourselves our subset of spatial hypersurfaces, spatial slices, let's call them sigma if you want, and we're going to connect these with some trajectory, some curves, gamma of t. And that's going to set up sort of time for us. And so basically, we're allowed to put whatever coordinates we want on these slices, but setting up this curve is going to allow us to connect the coordinates on the different slices. And basically, when you set up that curve, it doesn't have to be normal to these surfaces. It can go sort of wherever you want. But you can decompose the trajectory into a piece that's normal, right? That's actually normal to each of the hypersurfaces. And the piece that's sort of orthogonal along the spatial directions. And so the difference between how you set up your parameterization, t, and the time that you actually want gives you basically the two times are related by something called the lapse, which is n. And the sort of deviation that you go in the spatial directions are these shift vectors. Let's call them n sub I, the shift vectors. And basically what that does is it allows us to set up a metric that works in terms of these guys, But we know that these guys aren't real degrees of freedom because they just were something that told us how to slice up the space. So in some sense, we're going to get equations, we're going to get constraint equations for these that take care of some of our coordinate issues that we had before. And then we're going to have equations of motion from the action for the real degrees of freedom. So what we can do from this is we can write a metric ds squared is minus n squared dt squared. And then we need the part that's the spatial part on these surfaces. So on each of these surfaces, there's actually a metric, spatial metric, hij. So the full metric needs to have that metric sitting here. Some function of the coordinates, there's a dxi. But we can also mix sort of what the x here and the time was there, and that's this lap. That's given by this lattice vector. So ni dt, and then we need the same thing for j. Dxj and j dt. Okay? All right, so that also means, though, that since, so these, basically, these guys here, these are going to be not dynamical degrees of freedom, because that's basically our arbitrary choice of how we slice up space and time. But basically, the idea is that then what we're trying to solve for is the evolution of this hij. So hij as a function of time is going to be the dynamical thing that we solve for. So this is the name. So what we need to do then is to put this ansatz into our action, write things in terms of these ends, and we're going to have this variable that's dynamical, and we're going to have our matter perturbation, our phi or delta phi, that we're going to solve for. Okay? So we want to write, So let's write out the whole thing first, just in normal, familiar terms. So there's a root g, there's a 1/2, and Planck squared r, right? So this is the four curvature, the total curvature. And then for the matter part, we're going to have basically just g mu nu, d mu phi, d nu phi, minus v of phi. And I guess with my sign convention, I probably want a minus sign here. So you can see that the n's and the ni's are going to appear here, here, and here. So what you need to evaluate to simplify this, three things. You need to write minus root g is actually just going to be equal to n squared times root h. Sorry, n squared inside the square root, so n times root h. You actually need to invert this to get g mu nu upstairs. And we also need to work out what this r4 is. Okay. So this one's pretty easy to do. You can convince yourself that's true. This one I highly recommend you, for all this stuff, it's really actually extremely useful to set up a Mathematica notebook or something like that, right? Because it gets messy to do all these inversions. So this one I'm not going to show you what it is. I mean, I can if you want, but I'm just going to show you what happens when you plug it in here. And this one we'll work out a couple of steps of, okay? Because this one we're going to break up into something that depends on n, the time part, and something that depends on the spatial part, because this guy depends on hij, right? So this R3 part is going to depend just on this metric h on the spatial slices, and that's going to be where the dynamical piece lives. So it's important that we separate that off from n and ni. All right, so let's see. I think I won't show you. Let me just give you the expression for r so that you have it. So let's keep it over here. So I think you saw a little bit of this in the other courses as well, but let me just rewrite the expression for you, that r is actually equal to R3, which, as we said, is the normal expression for how you calculate the curvature, but just in terms of the metric hij. But then it also has pieces that depend on basically these n sub i's here. And those are combined in a particular combination, which is actually related to the extrinsic curvature of those slices, right? So how they're curved in the time direction. So let me call that n to the minus 2 combination Eij, Eij minus e squared, where Eij has one piece that's actually, that's a time derivative of this metric, Hij. So that's, again, that's a dynamical part. But then it has just derivatives of these n's in the symmetric combination, I and J, J and I. Okay? And this now is just the normal covariant derivative, but the covariant derivative just on the spatial part. So again, this is just coming from Hij. All right. So the most important thing is that when you actually plug all of that stuff in, we can write the new form of the action. So instead of root g, we're going to have root h now, because we pulled out the n. So then we've got n times r3. We've got the second term over there that was written in terms of those eij's. So n inverse eij ij minus e squared. So e squared is just when I contract the indices of e with itself, right? So this e is e ii, if you like. Okay. So it's k times n, or n squared, basically. Yeah, so some people, it's related to the extrinsic curvature, but there's some extra factors of n in there. Yeah, literally just one factor. So often, people define this kij. It's just n. Doesn't help you if you don't know what k is, but that's good. OK. All right. So these are the pieces that we got from expanding out r so far. And then we have terms that mix the n's and the scalar field, right? Because we had the g mu nu, and then we want to turn g mu nu into g mu nu upstairs and pull out the n's. Yeah?
So we erased the ij and the h, is that?
Yeah, that's right.
In the e,
in the e, yeah.
Upstairs, ij is erased by h.
Right? That's right, that's right. Yeah, this, that's right. So this is also e. Ij. That's right. So everything basically that comes with an I is always built out of Hij. Yeah.
So those covariant derivatives are three covariant derivatives.
That's right. That's right. You can look in most, you can look in like Wald, for example, or most GR books if you want to like go through all this stuff in detail and see how it's related to extrinsic curvature and all that. OK, so we have that guy. Then we have terms that mix the scalar field time derivatives and spatial derivatives. Square. And so basically, you can see that this is what happens when I took the g mu nu, which had the time derivatives and the space derivatives. And you can sort of understand why in front of the space derivatives there should be an ni, and in front of the whole thing there's an n. And then there's another term, which is just the contraction with just the spatial part. So that's an hij di phi dj phi, so just spatial derivatives. And then the potential, of course, the only thing that happened to the potential is we got the factor of n from the root g that became the root h. So this was just n times v of phi with a 2, I guess, because of the, because I took the 1 half out in front. Okay, so now you can see that for the n's and the ni's, there are no time derivatives appearing, right? There are spatial derivatives of them here, but no time derivatives. We do have time derivatives of phi, and we do have time derivatives of h, right? Because there's a time derivative of h sitting inside e. So this basically looks right for the fact that we're going to get dynamics for h and for phi, and just algebraic expressions constraints for n and ni. Okay. So basically, we took care of a lot of the issues that we had before with counting which degrees of freedom were sort of dynamical and which were gauge degrees of freedom, because we moved some of those coordinates into the n and the ni, right? If this is a full vector and this is a scalar, then this is 4 degrees of freedom. So you remember, really, if this is a full vector, we pulled out a scalar out of full vectors, and we were left with these vectors that had a special condition to remove 1 degree of freedom. So you remember when we were removing degrees of freedom from the pure scalars, we started with 4, phi, psi, b, and e, and we removed 2 of them thanks to gauge transformations, right? So those 2 scalars are already sitting inside here, and one of those small vectors is sitting inside of here. So this is doing the same thing for us as that first step that we did of removing those 2 scalars, which we had a freedom to do by coordinates, right? So these are doing, so these guys being, so constraints for these do the same effectively as our choice to define the capital phi and the capital psi for the scalars. Okay? Because here this is basically 2 scalars and 1 vector, where we always had this condition that di omega I, whatever we were calling it, was equal to 0. Okay? So, and the tensors still live in hij and another vector. So you can see that we've solved. So this has already done for us half of the work that we spent a lot of time doing before. But we know that we still have too many degrees of freedom left over, right? We still have phi, capital phi in some sense, capital psi in some sense, and delta phi. So we still need to choose a gauge. Right, one of these issues, before we worked out one of the Einstein equations that told us that phi was equal to psi in certain choice of background source when there was no anisotropic stress. So some of that should come out of the equation of motion for all these guys. But even so, we need to get down to 1 scalar degree of freedom. So we still have to make a choice. And making a choice effectively corresponds to saying something about delta phi and something about hij, right? Because the other scalars still live in hij. So a common choice, so here's we're going to go with something called co-moving gauge, where essentially you move along with the fluid. So here, the perturbation delta phi in our scalar field, we're going to set equal to 0. And then we have to make a choice for hij. So we want our normal scale factor to sit out in front, just like before. And basically, there's the same variable that we were calling, or a similar variable to what we were calling little psi before, that's going to sit inside here, but we're going to call it zeta now for reasons that will match with the zetas that we've been defining, sort of, that I've been throwing in there throughout the past couple days. So this is just times delta ij. And then there's, let's not call it h anymore, sorry, let's call it gamma. There's the tensor part that's left over, gamma ij. And this guy has the same, you know, the same constraints as before, that di gamma ij is 0, and this is traceless. Okay. So I'm ignoring the vectors, and that turns out to be consistent here. So basically, one of the vectors is again, sort of gauge degrees of freedom that are removed here. There's another one that sometimes you have to carry along, but for inflation, it turns out that it's going to be always be consistent to drop those guys. So I'm ignoring them. This is going to be the gravitational waves, tensor modes, and these are going to be our normal scalars.
In that, the first equation, the transverse, the thing that's being upstairs doesn't have any significance.
That's right. I mean, if you want it to look right, you can put it up there.
Yeah,
we can also.
If you're not raising it. With
that's right. That's right. Yeah. Thanks. Good. Okay. Okay, so that's our choice, and then we basically need to take this choice, plug it back in over there, right, and see what happens. So let me make a comment here that what we're doing now is starting to be perturbation theory, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to take our full action, and we're going to start expanding in the fluctuations in terms that are different powers of the fluctuations. So, of course, there's a term that has no powers of the fluctuations, so let me denote that as zero. So this is just the background. There would be a term that's one power of the fluctuations, but this is always gone, right, because it's basically just proportional to the equations of motion. So it always vanishes. The first term that we're interested in is a term that's quadratic in the fluctuations, right? So this is going to give us our normal equation of motion for what would have been like the free scalar field before. So this is going to give us equation of motion for zeta, delta phi, whatever the variable is we want to work with. And this is what's going to allow us to go through the same procedure of quantizing the field, getting the power spectrum. It's going to look exactly what you were doing with Andrew, except now this is an action for delta phi, or for zeta, for the fluctuations. But what's extremely useful about this, actually, is that you can keep going. You can ask about all the rest of the terms, third order and higher. And all of these guys are interactions, right? So these are the parts that make this different from being a free theory, which it would have been if we just stopped there, essentially, and that was all we had. And this is actually where a lot of the really interesting stuff happens. And in fact, this was getting at these terms was the reason that the very famous paper that sort of laid out how to do all of this for cosmology actually happened. And this was the reason for what's the classical reference for all this stuff, which is Maldacena's paper, which I think you got the reference for this before, but let me just give it to you again. Mr. PH. And these interactions are what gives rise to statistics that are different from statistics of a free field. Free field has Gaussian statistics, so these are non-Gaussian entities. And what's really almost remarkable in a way is you might think that to get this next term, this S3 term, you're going to have to keep expanding here. You're going to have to expand the ends and this guy to the next order, right? First order here, maybe gives you the first term. Second order, maybe gives you the second term. But it turns out that actually you don't have to do any more work than what we're going to do today to get this term as well. So it's extremely convenient that you only need basically first order perturbations in the ni and phi to get the result for the three-point function for S3. Now, to go to the next order, S4, you do need to do more work. But actually, all that we're going to do today is enough to get this. Yeah?
So the fact that quantum gravity is not non-renormal, does that have an effect on this theory?
So no, at this level. So basically, yeah. As long as we claim that we're always working below Planck energy scales, and as long as we claim that we're allowed to quantize the field in a consistent approach without quantizing gravity, So then we don't have to worry about it. Now, of course, you know, technically, if you want to try to use like this Hamiltonian, and maybe, I don't know, maybe we're not talked about this, if you want to try to use this Hamiltonian formalism and use some semi-classical expansion to start doing gravity, actually, you find that it's not going to be very helpful to try to do quantum gravity at higher order. So we don't really know what to do, right? But as long as we claim that we don't have to worry about quantum gravity and working below Planck energies and all that, then we don't have to worry. So there is a classical three-point for the graviton, right? As long as we're talking about classical graviton, there is a three-point just for that. And so you can use this to do everything that's still classical. Yeah, but it's very interesting because once you start looking at these interactions, you can start treating this as a real quantum field theory in curved space, right? You can start doing loop corrections. You can start doing all kinds of calculations that make this, that really test sort of the meat or the, you know, the underlying theory in a much more significant way. And, you know, that's where new results are. So we don't know the whole story. But I guess what's great and what we'll talk about tomorrow is that in this initial paper of Malvicena, when he did this calculation, part of the point was that the result for the models of inflation that we've been talking about so far is extremely tiny. So in some ways, you think never observable. So why are you doing this? But it's very interesting that by doing that, of course, you really are doing more serious field theory for inflation. But it turns out also that there are other models, lots of other models, where this is observable. And so then that makes even more of a reason to actually make sure that you know how to do these calculations, because, in fact, you might see it, and that is a good way of distinguishing between what the physics is, right? Because this is really the interactions now, so that's always how we distinguish physics. So it's very interesting. Okay, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Mostly I just want to point out that what we're going to do today is enough to get the answer that I'm going to show you tomorrow. Okay, so what do I want to do? All right, so I guess, yeah, we need to go ahead now and just plug this into the action so that we're going to be able to get equations, constraint equations for the ends and equations of motions for zeta. So we also have to make a prescription for how we expand the ends, right? So we expand it here. This is our perturbation. So this prescription is independent of the gauge choice, right? But we need to perturb or expand the metric, perturb the ni. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to say that our time is cosmological time, so n is 1 at lowest order, right? Because then that gives us the metric here that's, again, just, you know, minus dt squared plus a squared dx squared, the normal cosmological metric we're familiar with. And then we're going to add the next term, let's call it n1 downstairs, dot, dot, dot. And the n i's, right, again, we can separate that out. We said that's a normal three-component vector. We can separate out the piece that's just a scalar from that and the piece that's the actual vector. And let me call that, what did I call that? It's not going to matter very much because it's not going to really come in, but did I want to call it? Oh, I guess I was calling it psi. Is that confusing? No, I think, yeah, in fact, I think, do I have another psi? I don't. I have capital psi, but so I was calling this psi, the scalar part, di psi. And then there's the vector. Let me just label it again with a transverse symbol. Okay, it's the vector part. It's not going to matter because it's going to turn out the equation for this is trivial. We're going to drop the vectors anyway, but we will have psi. Okay. Let's do it. It's just, again, it's the same thing we've been doing. So this guy is defined so that di and I. All right. So basically, remember the other thing that we have that's going to simplify our life is that the background is only a function of time, right? So, So recall that we're the whole time we're saying that phi of x and t is phi naught of t plus delta phi. But in this gauge, which in principle is a function of x and t, but in this gauge we've actually set delta phi equals 0. So we're never going to have contributions from this term, right? Because if this is phi background, this is 0. If this is delta phi is 0, so this is 0. And we're never going to have contributions from this term. Okay? So actually, when we go to plug in and get the equations, it's much simpler because of that fact. All right. In fact, do I need to write down? Yeah, I think I won't write down. So basically, you're going to plug it in. You're going to ignore those two terms. And what we're after are the equations of motion. First, for n and ni, these are our constraints. And then, for zeta. Okay? So, equation of motion for n is pretty simple. So, of course, I erased Eij. But Eij, remember, so Eij had spatial derivatives. I better write that back up so we don't, so you can see what I'm doing. Sorry. Let me just put it back here. There was a time derivative of Hij, and then there were symmetric space derivatives of the n's. Okay, so that's not going to matter for equation of motion for capital N, but it will for ni. Okay, so equation of motion for capital N is really easy, right? Because n only enters as a constant. I mean, there are no derivatives, essentially. It's just n, right? So you can see that when we take the equation, it's just going to be the variation of L, the Lagrangian inside there. So for this guy, we're just going to need basically partial L, partial N equals 0. Okay. And you can see that what that gives us, certainly it gives us an R3. So I can drop all the stuff that's constants in front of everybody. There's an R3. There are no N's inside the E's, so we just get a minus N to the minus 2 Eij. Eij minus e squared. And then we get an n to the minus 2 times just the phi dot, right? There's a phi dot squared there. We don't have to worry about the other stuff because it's spatial derivatives. So we get a minus n to the minus 2 phi dot. And now this is phi background because the fluctuation is gone, squared. And this is also, let me put a, well, yeah, we need zeta out of there, I guess. Let me not put a bar. And then, so there's nothing from the next term, and there's only the term that's the potential, so that's just minus 2 times v of phi. And this, again, is phi naught because there's no fluctuation in delta phi. Yeah. So basically, we said that for phi, the background of phi is just a function of time. And the fluctuation is gone.
But even those at the end?
So right now I'm just doing the equation of motion for the lapse, which is the n without an index.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry, I know it's a bit confusing because, yeah. Too much notation. Okay? And then the second thing we need are the equation of motion for these ni's. And now the ni's, there are no... Again, there are no ni's without derivatives, right? Because the only ni's without derivatives were this one, which is gone. That's it, right? Because E only contains derivatives. And it only contains spatial derivatives. Okay? So again, we don't have to go into too much work. Basically, what the term we want here is going to be v by d, let's call it, let's say xi, of partial L with respect to di and j, right? So there's going to be an equation for each of the nj. And I can make that look a little more familiar form if I just swap the swap these guys to have lowercase, or downstairs and upstairs. And then it's easy to find the combinations that are partial I and j in there. Right, there's one inside E, basically. So there's just one inside EIJ, so we're going to get let's write it out, V by DXI. So there's the first term I need is the N inverse EIJ, EIJ minus E squared. So there's an N inverse in front of everybody. For EIJ, we've got, if you take the upstairs one, right, you can see that the derivative is just going to give us the whole EIJ that's in front of that EIJ. And we're not going to worry about the minus because there's a minus everywhere. But then there's the E squared term, which has an extra minus. And because one of the E's is contracted, right, there's really a delta function, a delta IJ in there. Or sorry, it's actually an HIJ, since I made everything lowercase, it's an HIJ times E. And then there's nothing from the phi term, there's nothing from the phi term, there's nothing from the potential term. So I think that's it. Does that look right? So if I now put the derivative back upstairs where so that it's familiar, I can write this as, so yeah, this is the whole time this should have been a, technically it should have been a covariant derivative, right? But here, now I move the index up. So let me move it back down. And I've got inverse n e I j. And now when I move this up, this is a delta ij times e equals 0. Yeah, I think that's right. OK, so now, and again, this is where Mathematica is useful. To solve this, what you want to do is plug in our prescription for n's, right? And you want to solve to find the constraints for n and ni. So that's a lot of algebra. But the result is really easy, and it's at least easy to plug it in and see that it works if you want. One and two. In terms of our perturbations, and one and we just call it psi. We find. So you remember that HI or the R3, right, and HIJs, they all contain zeta. So basically what we're going to find are constraints for what the n's have to be in terms of zeta. Delta phi was vanishing. So we find n1 is zeta dot over h. And the vector part of this guy is 0, so that's fine. We've been ignoring all that stuff. We can keep ignoring it. But the psi, a to the minus 2, zeta over h plus something called chi, which is only defined with its derivative. It's a background phi dot squared over 2h. So in some sense, this is a slow roll thing, right? This is like epsilon and zeta dot over a blank squared. So now we can get what we want, right? The whole thing we were after is the action. Yeah. Basically, when you do the solution, you find this thing plus d to the minus 2 of this thing. So then you can just call chi the thing that you're taking the derivative of.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, sorry.
So chi is a solution of that
yeah.
equation.
Okay. And so let me just say that this is just algebra, it's just a lot of it. But now we have what we want. So now we can write S. And really, we're just going to write this part we sort of already know. This is the part we're after. Purely just in terms of the dynamical variables. And that's what's going to allow us to get the equation of motion for zeta. Okay? So, need to put solutions for n and I back in the action. And you find something very simple. So here I can basically write this as if it looked like an action I'm familiar with, as long as what I put inside the root G is the background metric. So this is just my background FRW. You know what? This is an important equation, so actually maybe I should write it someplace where we could save it. Let's put it over here. Obviously, this is going to be some function, zeta dot. But let's write what it is. So the first thing that's interesting about this is that it's proportional to epsilon. So remember, epsilon is related to phi zero dot. So what I've done is I've used, let me put it over here again. If you go back to your, well, all the equations that we had for the background solution, you can see that phi zero dot squared is 2 epsilon and Planck squared h squared. But epsilon, remember, is something that's useful because it always keeps in mind the fact that if we're in exact de Sitter space, epsilon is equal to 0. So this whole thing is proportional, interestingly, to epsilon. And it's also just depends on derivatives of zeta. Time derivatives, and exactly the same thing for spatial derivatives. Right? So this is effectively just g mu nu mu zeta, g mu zeta. Okay? Okay, so notice. This thing vanishes if epsilon does. So what's that? Go ahead. Yeah. So G bar is this is the unperturbed background metric. This is the FRW.
Yeah, and this is but in terms of the parameters that have been set,
so far. It's just. This guy says 0. So it's the usual minus 1 a squared. Yeah, anything else, actually? Sorry. So it's a lot of equations. Anything else about them that's not clear? Okay. So this is the first important point, which we sort of knew before, right? If I have exact de Sitter space, completely exact for all time, there's not really any meaning to the metric fluctuation in some sense. So what we've seen here is that's literally true here. If we had exact de Sitter space, epsilon equals 0, this term would be 0, right? And we'd be done, essentially. So exactus, that what this is telling us is that an exactus sitter, all scalar perturbations at this order are gauge modes. The second thing is that up to this factor of epsilon and a factor of 2, I guess, this is essentially the action for a massless scalar field, right? Just to this quantity. So up to a factor of 2 epsilon, and the fact that it's, it's exactly it. This is the equation. This is the action. Which is great, because now we know exactly where we're going. We know what the equation of motion is going to look like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Okay, so in fact, let's just do that. Let's write down the equation of motion for zeta. And you can work it out, but I'm just going to write it because we're short on time. So basically, there's a term that's just the derivative of zeta. Sorry, you have to take derivatives of the variations of this guy with respect to the derivatives here. There's going to be this is really a cubed. There's going to be a dt of a cubed times 2 zeta dot, all that. So I'm going to already take the derivative and work it out just basically one step down the line so that you can see it. And I'm going to simplify a couple terms. It's really two lines. But you have the second derivative term, zeta. And again, I'm going to work already now in the Fourier modes, okay, for spatial part. Zeta k double dot, standard thing, 3h zeta k dot. There's a term that would depend on the variation of epsilon, right, when I take a derivative of this. So that's going to be an epsilon dot over epsilon times a zeta k dot. We're going to drop that guy and say it's small for the time being. So we're going to say epsilon is nearly constant, essentially. And then there's the normal 1/2 k squared over a squared zeta k. Okay, so that should look familiar. Same thing we had before, except this term, which we're going to drop anyway. Okay, so two things. First of all, you know the solution to this equation, and I think you already know this feature too. So notice that when k squared over a squared h squared is very small. Make sure I get it right. Small superhorizon modes. If this is small, this term is small compared to this term and this term. Right? Again, that you can think of the derivative as giving you the factor of h here. If that's the case, then our equation is really simple, right? Theta k double dot 3h zeta k dot equals 0, which tells us first that zeta equals constant is a solution, and second that the other solution is exponentially decaying. It goes like e to the minus 3ht outside the horizon, right? So I think you probably saw this feature before, but this is what's telling us that zeta is the good mode to work with outside the horizon. It's essentially constant. There's one solution that's constant, one solution that decays, so that's why actually this is the great variable to solve for all the purposes of cosmology, like we talked about yesterday, okay? That's right, superhorizon. That's right. So the thing is oscillating inside. Outside the horizon, it basically goes to a constant and stays a constant regardless of what happens. So zeta constant, which is what we wanted. Okay. It's also really easy now to write down the solution for the power spectrum, right? Because you know the solution. If this was our normal massless scalar fields up to this 2 epsilon, you know what the solution is because you did it several times. So it's easy now to transform and say what the solution is for the power spectrum of zeta.
K squared over A squared A squared is less than 0, right? I mean, much less than 1.
Thank you. Yeah, it's not obvious. Basically, I made an assumption, and the reason that that's sort of reasonable is that if you remember, we could define eta as epsilon dot over epsilon h as the logarithmic derivative of epsilon. So it's sort of reasonable that things are changing smoothly, and if they're smooth, the second derivative of h, which is essentially this, isn't too big. So this is just an assumption, small. We assumed it. It's not that big a deal to actually put that in, actually. We sort of did it. We did something very similar when we added a mass for the scalar field. It was relatively similar. So you can actually put that correction in, but it's easier to see this.
Just in terms of dimensions, the epsilon there is dimensionless, right?
That's right. So you can see that this zeta is a dimensionless field at this point, right? Because it was this perturbation inside the metric. And this is important because the three things that are going to happen, which we're going to do right now to change it into the intuition that you know, is we're going to make zeta the canonical field that has mass dimension 1, which involves an M Planck and a root 2 epsilon. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, I was just wondering whether the phi naught dot had mass units, usual. In which case, yeah, you get epsilon dimensionless.
Yeah. Good. Yep. So that's the last step that we need to do. Basically, what we need to do is define. If we define the canonical zeta, let's call it zeta k hat. That's going to be equal to M Planck, I think root 2 epsilon, zeta k that we have. Is my root 2 right? Let's see. No, it needs to be over. That's right, actually, right? Because I want it 1/2 here and I want to cancel it here. I think that's right. Okay, so if we do that, then we know the answer for zeta k hat, right? Because you've worked out how many times that in the bunch Davies vacuum, I look zeta k hat 1, zeta k hat 2, correlation function of these guys, 2 pi cubed, delta function, and you know the answer is h squared over 2 k cubed. Doesn't matter k1, k2. So then we know that for zeta, which is the variable we actually had, let's just look at this. This is what we were calling p of k. Well, let me write the whole thing since I started. P of k is the same thing, but now I've got these extra factors, right? So I had zeta hat. I want zeta k, so I divide by all that stuff, squared. So that's a 1 over 2 epsilon m Planck squared. So basically, if I look at the dimensionless thing, right, to get the dimensionless thing, we multiplied p of k by k cubed, and we divided by this 2 pi squared factor. That 2 pi squared factor was coming from basically the angular integrals when we assumed spherical coordinates, right, and did the angular integrals for the Fourier transform. So what we get is that delta squared, sorry, for zeta, as a function of k, is just going to be h squared. We have 2, 2, 2 is 8. Pi squared, epsilon, m Planck squared. And that's the result that we want, because that's the result for the variable constant outside the horizon that we map back into the stuff that comes in the horizon that we relate to the temperature and the curvature later. So the important thing here is that it depends on the scale of inflation, but because it's a scalar mode, and so there's this wrapping up between the gravitational degrees of freedom and the delta phi degree of freedom, this epsilon appears here. Okay, so it doesn't quite, the amplitude of this, which is what's constrained literally by inflation, doesn't quite tell us the scale of inflation. It tells us the scale of inflation modified by something, which is this epsilon. Okay, so let me make just a couple points. And I guess I'll leave some of this for the tutorial maybe then. So comments. First one is, there's another very common gauge choice, different gauge choice. Which is the basically the constant curvature gauge. And the constant curvature gauge, you keep delta phi, but you set zeta essentially equal to zero. So this hij is just delta ij plus gamma ij. Delta phi equals not zero. And hij is a squared delta ij plus gamma ij. And it's constant curvature because if you work out the 3 curvature, R3, that goes like zeta essentially. And that was also, I think, in the tutorial. And so when zeta is not there, essentially those slices are spatially flat. So constant curvature or spatially flat is actually better. And you can also work out the solution in this gauge. It's very easy. You can work it out at horizon crossing, but zeta is always the variable that you want outside the horizon because zeta is constant. So if you do this, you can find let's call it delta phi. But then you make a gauge transformation. Say evaluated at horizon crossing k equals ah. Make a gauge transformation to find zeta. Because that's the variable that you want. But people often do that. And that the gauge transformation that you use here is something pretty much what you worked out in the tutorial, I think. Because you really are transforming essentially between surfaces of constant density in some sense following the fluid to surfaces that are spatially flat. Okay? It was a homework actually. It's the homework 2. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. So homework 2 you did part of this and yeah. So I don't have time to go through it, but it's pretty simple. Anyway, it's essentially this result that zeta is minus h over phi dot delta phi. We sort of talked about it yesterday too. Okay? Okay. And the other comment I want to make is related to the gravitational waves. So you worked out, hopefully, the tensor power. So you found, let me call it PT, and you found this as the sum of the, or you could find it as the sum of the power in the two modes, H plus and H cross, for the tensors. So you found 4 tensors. And basically, you should have found that this thing was H squared over 2K cubed. If you were working in sort of the standard variable, and when you transform, and there are some factors of 2, and when you transformed into the, this was canonical, which implied that when you got rid of the k cubed and you went into the canonically normalized, so this was the canonically normalized variable, so you backed out to the original h variable, you should have found that delta squared for tensors, the function of k, again, it's essentially nearly constant, was almost the same thing without the epsilon. There's a pi squared, and I think there's a factor of 2 because this was 2 times the h plus and the h cross. So the important thing of this is that people define something called R, which is an observable that's the ratio of the power in tensors to the power in scalars. This is really p zeta. Sorry, let me write it in terms of delta squared since that's a dimensionless thing. Delta squared tensor over delta squared, let's call it zeta. And that thing is equal to, if I got my factors of 2 right, 16 epsilon. small, right? So one of the most interesting questions in cosmology is this observable? Because if this is observable, and basically we phrase it as a ratio because we only know the power in scalars, right? So it's a ratio to how well we're going to do compared to that. But you can see that if it's observable, what you get is the actual scale of inflation. You get h here, right? We didn't quite get the scale of inflation there because of the epsilon. If it's observable, that's very important information because you get the scale of inflation, h. But it's really hard because this is really small. And just how hard it is turns out to be related to this old question of how far the field moves in field space. Is it super Planckian or sub Planckian? And how likely is related to delta phi over m Planck? It's essentially of order one or not. And this goes by the name of the life bound. And you'll work out a little bit more detail about that. I think that was also in the homework. Okay. So some of the biggest questions in cosmology today are we ever going to see tensor modes? If we do see them, are we more convinced that inflation is right? If we do see them, does that mean that the inflationary model had some special symmetry so that we were protecting ourselves against all the possible terms that could be in the action? And the second question is the one that we'll talk about tomorrow, which is, great, we've measured the power spectrum, right? We already said that what we measured here were basically two numbers, A naught and the spectral index, and it's minus one. But you can make up a zillion models that give you those two numbers. So the next interesting question is to ask, what else can you say about inflationary models past that? And that's what we had here as this expansion in interaction terms, which is non-Gaussianity. And so that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. Yeah. The life bound, named after David Life, who wrote the paper about it. Yeah.
So the delta zeta squared.
Yeah.
The middle is k cubed tk over 2 pi. Is that something that we usually can integrate? Oh, so this is the thing that sits inside the integral.
Exactly. So when we were computing the real space 2-point, we had a Anything else? Okay, last day tomorrow.